Between tour cancellations, lost creative gigs, and shrinking ad revenue, the COVID-19 crisis is making it clear that the system supporting creative people is broken. Patreon offers a better way. We help creators make up lost revenue and build a more sustainable income source by offering a monthly membership to their fans. In turn, fans get access to exclusive community, premium content, and the chance to become active participants in the work they love. Check out patreon.com now and help change the way art is valued.
Let's talk about education. Schools are shut down across the country. And as a nation, we're testing the limits of our education system. It's unprecedented and unfamiliar. That's why Verizon and the New York Times are working together to give every high school in America free digital access to Times journalism through July 6th. It's never been more important for students to stay informed and engaged with the world around them. Learn how to register your school at nytimes.com/highschoolaccess. Data rates apply.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your choose your words carefully of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
We will not tolerate. We will not tolerate.
Things are no better in the country. No better. And as you guys know from last week, I wasn't quite sure how to do Popcast or what we should do with that previous episode that we had recorded before things really got out of hand. And I was thinking a lot about how I want to handle this week's show. It occurred to me that there are precedents for the current cultural and political moment. And I was wondering, how did the magazines that I grew up reading, The Source especially, what were they doing around the time of the Los Angeles uprisings? And I'm very fortunate in that two of my OGs are Reggie Dennis and James Bernard, who were top-ranking editors at The Source during the early 90s. And I have a lot of old Source issues, and I have a lot of issues from 1992, but I didn't have the key one, which is the August 1992 issue. And I hit Reggie, and I asked him if he had it, and he did, and he took pictures of what their coverage was and sent it to me. And I got to read a very long piece by James about going to Los Angeles, riding around South Central, talking to regular folks, talking to political folks, talking to gang members, and really painting a picture of what the vandalism and looting and also the political potential of that moment meant from a perspective that was radically different from how the mainstream news was covering Los Angeles in that moment. And then I realized that's what I want Popcast to be about this week. I want Popcast to be about, how did The Source cover that moment? What are the responsibilities of music-related publications, hip-hop publications, to rise to moments like the one that we are experiencing in our country right now? I'm very fortunate that James and Reggie agreed to come on and talk about that. So this week, that's what we're going to get into. It's The Source, 1992, the Los Angeles uprisings. James Bernard is here, who's a senior editor of The Source. James, what's good?
How you doing?
Good. And Popcast listeners know Reggie Dennis. He's been on Popcast before. Reggie was the music editor of The Source. Reggie, what's good?
Nice to be back.
I want to talk about the decisions behind covering the LA uprisings and what that meant for a magazine like The Source in 1992. You know, right from jump, Reggie, you was good enough to dig up this issue. This is the August 1992 issue. It's a too short cover. And it says, LA, message behind the madness, with a photo of a burning store. But the thing that I want to point to first, before we get into some of the specifics, is what it says under The Source, the magazine of hip-hop, music, culture, and politics. And politics. At that time, predating what happened in LA, how much was politics a part of what you guys envisioned The Source should be doing and was doing?
Well, I mean, that was kind of baked into the DNA of The Source. So almost from the very beginning, as far as I can remember, as soon as I started editing pieces, we just naturally included pieces that were, you know, social commentary, politics in it, that kind of thing.
Reggie, to what degree, as a music editor, what were you seeing that was happening in hip hop at that time, 88, 89, 90, 91, that sort of helped set the table for a magazine like The Source to really go in on this? And we should also caveat this by saying magazines like Rolling Stone and Spin obviously had been covering politics and social movements for a decade or two decades or more. So it's not that there's no precedent. There just wasn't a hip hop magazine prior to The Source really engaging like that. But anyway, Reg, what about the music?
Well, the coverage up until that point was very one-sided and often negative towards hip hop and towards the people involved. Rap was seen to cause violence. It wasn't art. It wasn't music. And it was almost like an annoyance to the industry. But even back then, it made so much money. People had to pay attention, but they typically held their noses and dealt with it. Now, everyone is 22 years old and basically just getting out into the world. But at 22, what are your life experiences? What you've seen? And a lot of places where the music was being created, there were things going on that would be covered in the music. And when we covered those records in The Source, our perspective wasn't that, oh my God, this is some alien experience. This was something that was quite natural to us. So that's what set The Source apart. So as far down the field as the cultural commentary went in this music, we pretty much always agreed with it, which was so different from anything else that you could read. You know, we didn't have a political agenda outside of promoting hip hop, promoting rap music, promoting the free speech of hip hop. So you could listen to Slick Rick, you could listen to NWA, you could listen to Ice-T, you could listen to MC Light, and all those disparate viewpoints were embraced. So to have a magazine called the Magazine of Hip Hop Music, Culture, and Politics meant that anything that came up was within our purview to cover.
The music grants you the umbrella to do the politics and all the other stuff that are in the pages. And it's interesting because I think, you know, when I look at the sort of sea changes over the years of hip hop publications, there's kind of been periods where politics was heavily embraced and periods where it was de-emphasized. I think we're coming back into a period where it's being re-emphasized. But what you guys were doing is, you know, you also decide to do real on the ground reporting. So I'd love to kind of get into, James, what made you decide to get on a plane? So if from our text yesterday, Reggie was saying you got on the plane the morning after the verdict, the Rodney King verdict, if I'm not mistaken. I'm looking at the editorial that Chris Wilder wrote. What was the decision process to get on the plane and go out there? Because I presume you went from New York to LA. And how was it taken in the building, the choice to do that?
I don't remember a lot of conversation about it, Reggie. I don't know if you remember a lot of conversation. I remember that there were a couple people who didn't get it at first, didn't understand that we may have a different kind of access to people. I think when you look at the article, there were people that I spoke with, I don't think any other reporters were talking to.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is, and I'll quote some stuff later from your piece, but even in this editorial, there was something that just very much struck me because it's relevant to how events like this have been covered over the years and are still covered sometimes. And this is, again, this is Chris Wilder's editorial. And this is none of these publications had reporters whose relatives and friends were out there grabbing TVs and 9mm alongside everyone else. None of their stories were reported by people who don't view the cops as their friend, but instead fear and despise them on a daily basis. And, you know, for all the talk about journalism and the practice of journalism as sort of a neutral act, obviously people bring their life experiences to bear on how they approach the practice of journalism. And walking into that situation with a different perspective, you're going to come out with different material, obviously. So the folks who didn't get it, Reg, I mean, we touched on this a little bit, I think, yesterday. Was it a hard sell, or were you just like, you don't get it and shrug and you're going to have to accept that you don't get it?
We learned about the verdict that afternoon, went home. I turned on CNN or something, and Los Angeles was on fire. So the next morning, I come into work. It's me and John Schechter, the editor-in-chief and founder. And I'm like, what are we going to do? How are we going to cover this? This is insane. Now, mind you, we're a monthly magazine. whatever we do is not going to hit the stands for 6 or 7 weeks.
Right. This is the August issue we end up in.
Yeah.
And the verdict is the 29th of April.
So there's the chance that everyone in the world is going to cover this, and possibly someone is going to have our perspective. And John Schechter, probably feeling that we would be late on the story, just felt that the mainstream media would do a competent job in covering it. And there really wouldn't be anything for us to add. And I was totally appalled by that, because this was the reason why we made the magazine, for something like this. As music editor of the magazine, I could have still filled those pages without talking about music at all, you know, because that's how wide hip hop is. So I wanted to see what James in particular would do, because I figured James would be the guy to write it. I didn't know that he would hop on a plane immediately. I called James because even in New York that night, there were little skirmishes, not full on riots, not looting, but people were disobeying orders. I joked. I called him up at home and I asked him, you know, did you get a television set last night? And you said, what? What are you talking about? And I'm like, dude, Los Angeles has been burning all night long. Don't tell me you didn't see any of this. And of course you hadn't, because you go to bed at like 8 o'clock.
This is also, this is an instructive, you know, for our younger listeners, pre-Twitter, you know, very early basic cable era, not loads of accessible news, reliable news.
Exactly. I wasn't getting texts on my phone. I didn't watch TV. I didn't even know if I had cable.
By the time James got to the office, he'd already booked his flight. And that afternoon, I interviewed MC Ren. I had a phoner with him. And the next morning, I flew out to Oakland to interview Too Short. So we were all just sort of gravitating towards the epicenter of the conflict, which no one else was really doing at that time, because we're running towards it. Everyone else is probably trying to maintain a safe distance. And when you read some of James's story, he's part of it, because he's rolling with a Crip set the whole weekend.
So the story, just so people know, and I don't believe this is on the internet anywhere. I mean, this is one of the many tragedies of this particular era of music journalism, and the source specifically, a lot of this early stuff is just not online. But again, Reggie was good enough to take some photos of the pages for me. The story is called The LA Rebellion, Message Behind the Madness. It's about 8 or 9 pages. And James, when you booked your plane ticket, there are cell phones, but this is not like an instantaneous connection moment. How did you decide or know how you would find entree into the story? And how did you ultimately gain entree into the story?
We had networks on the ground. When I got there, I drove straight to South Central. Greg Everett introduced me to Lil V.
Can you explain who Lil V, just for, I mean, I've read the piece, but can you just explain where those networks really were?
I mean, he was a mid-level Crip. He's actually passed away. He got shot like 2 years after that. So yeah, it wasn't even through an artist. It was through people who knew the magazine. I didn't see another reporter, I don't think, the whole time I was there.
I mean, it seems like you were moving almost exclusively in spaces that reporters at mainstream organizations were either scared to go into or were unawares of how to go into or whatnot. And as you were sort of gathering string and talking to people, did people embrace the idea of talking to a reporter, even a Black reporter from the source? Was there skepticism at all? Or were people like, finally, someone is here who wants to talk to us?
Well, I mean, I think it was more like, of course you're here to talk to us. I mean, I don't think that people would have been, where's the source? But it seemed like a natural thing to be there. You know, certainly I had a certain level of credibility with folks. I mean, I reread the article this morning, and it wasn't until the end when somebody sort of questioned my credentials. But, you know, I had people who vouched for me. So I think people were happy to be listened to by somebody who was respectful and somebody who would sort of get the nuances. Because, you know, reading the piece now, it was a more, like, I guess the word is nuanced situation than it looked like from the outside.
Maybe now's an interesting time to talk about language. So on the first page, you talk very specifically about, you say, this was no riot, it was a rebellion. You're making a very specific, I mean, I think people still colloquially refer to these events as the LA riots, but you're making a choice here in the headline and in that statement, which is in the sixth or seventh paragraph. Do you want to talk about making that choice and why it's important to understand it through that lens as a rebellion?
What's important is that some of the activity was conscious. People were, as I write in a piece, they were, this store doesn't hire people from the neighborhood. This store does. This store is Black owned. This store is Black owned, but it doesn't hire people. This hotel is in a Lyric. So, you know, we're not going to hit that. And everybody talked about this event being about social justice, not just about that one incident.
You also have Corky Nemec quoting Martin Luther King, just FYI. For those who don't know, Corky Nemec was an actor who was the main character on a show called Parker Lewis Can't Lose. And he was also kind of one of those like early 90s white LA actors who also tried to rap.
They all read the source.
Yeah, of course. Honestly, in an issue later that year, you're out there dragging Bud Bundy for rapping. I'm sure he felt a way about that.
I still feel bad about that.
It's okay. I think he's recovered. I think he's all right.
So when I look at this, I mean, that's the reporting that people weren't getting. You know, I think that people were thoughtful about what they were doing. We can sort of disagree with the whole idea of looting. That's fair. But at least in this instance, people were making a statement about who they wanted in their communities and who they didn't want in their community. And to me, that's a rebellion.
You know, I'll read one thing that you wrote. In this light, this is from your piece. In this light, the riots, in quotes, were really a very disciplined and spontaneous cry for economic empowerment. In italics, we know which businesses we wanted out of the community, which is to say that's what you were hearing from people. The message, we want more Black and Hispanic businesses, and we want businesses that respect us and give something back to the community. And there's one example that you underscore in a different section of the piece, where, as you were mentioning before, there's a sort of a row of buildings or a row of stores, and it's kind of one has been attacked, one has been left, one has been attacked, one has been left. And you were asking why. And they were, the people you're with were articulating and saying, they were saying very specifically, this store has owners that don't hire from the community. That store is Black owned, et cetera, et cetera. So this kind of coverage at this level of detail, was there any mainstream outlet, whether it was a newspaper or television news at the time, was anybody else getting this kind of granular detail?
I don't think so. In fact, when I reread it, you know, it's like nobody else was. I mean, part of it was nobody thought to talk to. Remember, when we started the source, people were saying that this generation doesn't read. They would never read a magazine, right? So that's the lens through which people were looking at not only our audience, but, you know, this was our audience. So nobody's taking these folks seriously. And of course, they're not opening up to people who they didn't think would get it. And like I said, I didn't see any other reporters. All the coverage was about this thing being lawless and sort of random. And I don't know if what some were reporting about what's going on now. I mean, it seems like what happened in LA at the time was really intelligent.
There was an article that the Times ran maybe 2 days ago, talking about how things have changed in the last 30 years. And one thing that is striking about this current set of protests, and by extension, some of the things that are coming with the protests, which is some of the vandalism and whatnot, is that it's being very deliberately brought not to Black neighborhoods, it's being brought to wealthier neighborhoods, to white neighborhoods. It's in Soho, it's in Buckhead, and, you know, it's in Beverly Hills. Not that there are not Black people who live in those neighborhoods or who patronize those neighborhoods. But there's a very deliberate choice to bring these messages outside of the Black and brown communities into the face of white communities. And that's something that's really striking. And that, again, strategic. It's a choice. And if something bad is going to happen, it will happen there, not in the communities. Reg, you said that day you flew out to talk to Too Short. So when you're out there, did you then feel my Too Short story is also going to be about this? Does it come up in that story? And how much were you then making it sort of the part and parcel of when we interview artists now, we're going to kind of get their opinions and thoughts on this.
I get to San Francisco and I'm taking the bus to the Diva Hotel, and there's a detour because something had just happened. And when they let me off by the hotel, there were a lot of police. There was a lot of broken glass. And this was 2 days later, 2 days after the verdict. And things were still going on, you know, at like 11 in the morning. So I really didn't know what I should do. Should I walk around, you know, shorts in Oakland? Like, can he come over and get me? Like, you know, what's going to happen? So I go upstairs and I just watch CNN for like the first like 6 hours. When I finally catch up with Short, they're pretty nonchalant about everything because it was primarily a Los Angeles thing and they were watching it like everyone else. But, you know, driving through Oakland, there were a couple things that burned. There was a lot of graffiti, but it was just something that everyone was reacting to, not necessarily living the way people were in Los Angeles. And I thought that was interesting because I didn't know what to expect, but Oakland is kind of a place that has its own drumbeat and they'll do what they do on their schedule, not to follow everyone else. If the officers involved with Rodney King got acquitted, they weren't surprised. They know the nature of the beast. They know the nature of the threat. Also, part of our job is to cover this music, cover a new album. And it's really up to the artist whether or not they want to talk about it or how far they want to go, right? When we all get back to New York, okay, what's going to be the cover? We have a too short story that I'm really pushing for this cover. But is the LA Rebellion something we're never going to experience again? Because at this point, we don't know. But my argument is there are probably less opportunities for Too Short to have a cover than there will be for us to cover Civil Unrest. I was betting that we would be where we are today. So again, when you see that cover, it's just like the weird dichotomy and the contradictions of hip hop are just right there.
I do want to point out one thing, James, I had not noticed this before, but here on the cover, the skyline does say the LA riots.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I think because Rebellion wouldn't fit at the top.
Right. Well, the networks wouldn't show you is what I assume it says. It's cut off.
Well, you know, we're selling.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why it was, you know, and also I think people who wrote the cover copy were different, but I don't think Rebellion would have fit up there. I remember this conversation about Too Short. Also, you have to remember that at the time at the Source, there was sort of, I mean, it wasn't a battle, but there were some of us who gravitated towards hip hop that originated on the West Coast and the South. And there were still people that we refer to as, they weren't backpackers, but they were definitely New York
to Philly. And that was it.
And so, and proud of it. And Reggie and I were Too Short fans. So, you know, for me also, I wanted Too Short in a cover because I was a Too Short fan. And I think in retrospect, it was the right decision. I mean, it's a great cover, I think, too.
It's not underplayed. I mean, you literally have a photo of like a burning building. It's not underplayed.
No, John, we almost had a superimposed photograph of Rodney King bruised up over a burning building. Like those are the choices. You know, distributors, news vendors were already nervous about this magazine to begin with. So people want to read about Too Short. They want to read about what makes the Source the Source. They also want to read about the Rebellion. They know they're going to get it. We're not shortchanging anyone. We're not ignoring anything. So it was really a coin toss. But back then, if you're defined as a rap magazine, even though we'd had Malcolm X on the cover, you want to stay on brand as much as possible. And those were a lot of the conflicts. Well, what is the Source brand? What is hip hop? Is TLC hip hop? Should we have Dr. Dre with a gun to his head? You know, we would give our publisher problems every day. And I'm sure these discussions were going on at other magazines, but we were so close to the material. Many of us had lived a lot of this material. So we wanted everything to be as uncut, unexpurgated as possible. The language, the images, the point of view, non-judgmental. You know, I'll tell the James Bernard story. When he gets to South Central, there's like a white family taking pictures of some of the ruins. And one of the guys James is with just takes the camera and hands it to James. And James spends the rest of the weekend with this stolen camera taking pictures. So when we get the film developed, kids, we had to get the roles developed. The first third of the first role is this white family on vacation. That is the apocalypse.
I forgot about that because it's a reference to the camera in the article. And I was like, I don't remember owning a camera. And and then there was a scene in there where the guy, the cops come up beside us and he's flicking off the cops. We were buck wild. And, you know, I'm going from neighborhoods of gangs that have been at war for 30 years, you know, and people are like, you know, I mean, maybe not 30 years. I mean, I wasn't scared. I don't remember at all being afraid because those were our folks. Those were the you know, they were fans of the magazine.
So there is I don't want to say a secondary narrative, but there is another through line in your article, which is about gang war de-escalation, which is something that had already been in motion prior to the verdict. There had been meetings. You talk about this a little bit, but there had been meetings between leaders of certain sets, sort of setting the table. And then in the immediate aftermath of the verdict and the uprisings, kind of this collective understanding of you're not my enemy. You're not my enemy. They're the enemy. We're opposed to them. We're opposed to what they're doing to us. And that's kind of the second half of your piece really, really gets into that. And I'd like to hear more about that because I think, I'm not sure if this is the story you were aiming to tell when you got on the plane to go there, but it's tending towards a hopeful note. There is some skepticism right at the end of the piece, but overall the piece is tending towards a hopeful note about what's going to happen in South Central, in South Los Angeles, with young people who just 3 weeks earlier had been really, really deep in gang life.
And it happened so quickly. I mean, when I hit the ground, you know, I witnessed people who were at war, like the guy that, and the brother I'm in the picture with is a Blood. I spent most of the time in Crip neighborhoods. And so I remember when we published that picture, I was like, this is not really representative of the piece. Like, this is a guy who, you know, I met him and we may have hung out, he says euphemistically, but, you know, I don't remember interviewing that guy, but he came to this neighborhood and hadn't really been over there. You know, I referenced people who had been in elementary school together, hadn't seen each other in years. I mean, I was seeing this and it was amazing how quickly people had come together. Because even though I'm not from there, I knew how deep, you know, that person killed my friend. You know what I'm saying? That kind of thing. And then how quickly that happened. And then in the back of the piece, the last sidebar was about a set of demands that were put together by Crips and Bloods with the help of one of their lawyers. And it's very hopeful. I mean, these folks thought this was the beginning of a new day.
And not just hopeful, but I mean, things that I'm sure protesters are seeking right now. If you told me this was put out this week.
I mean, I wish it was put out this week.
It's two columns on the last page of your piece. There are different subheads, facelift for the city, education, economic development, human welfare, and law enforcement, very strikingly. And I'd like to read the law enforcement one. This is from the Bloods and Crips proposal. Law enforcement, the Bloods and Crips demand that any police personnel be residents of the communities that they are assigned to patrol, something we hear a lot. Borrowing an idea from the Black Panthers, they recommend that former gang members should be hired as, quote, patrol buddies. After going through training, these buddies will monitor all police activity armed with video cameras to fight potential abuses.
I mean, it's very forward-thinking.
So forward thinking. And obviously, we're just on the heels of Rodney King. We're a year after Rodney King, which is really the first video captured police brutality video that gets widespread attention. This really anticipates what we have now to some degree and what is still lacking.
Oh, yeah. And also, what I thought was interesting, well, look, federal government, human welfare. So the subheads, LA facelift, right? They want to turn over abandoned buildings for counseling centers and recreation areas. People being bored, young people being bored and not having things to do was a big refrain. It's a whole thing on education, law enforcement, economic development, human welfare, where they talk about building hospitals in communities, dental offices. And then at the end of it, it said, in return, the Bloods and Crips will and request the drug lords of Los Angeles to take their monies and invest them. It's unbelievable that this happened within days, within a couple of weeks of the rebellion.
And a lot of this reminds me of, look, on Instagram and Twitter, you see a lot of people talking about defunding police and reallocating resources to other departments. It's been a big issue in Los Angeles about the disproportionate amount of the upcoming budget that's devoted to policing as opposed to social services. I read this and this reads exactly like that.
We thought this was the revolution. It seems so naive, but it wasn't, just because of the way people were talking. I mean, the problem was, it petered out. There was no organization to sustain things and keep organizing going, but the impulse was there. People thought this was revolutionary, and it was, really. Look, when people loot without condoning it, and I'm not just saying that because I'm talking to the New York Times, but without condoning it, that's sort of class struggle. If a consumer-oriented society dangles all this stuff in front of you all the time, and you can't have it. You can't have it because something's wrong with you, because you can't earn enough money. So how do you fight back? It's very vulgar, and it's very short-sighted, but it's also like, I'm angry. What am I going to do? I'm going to take this. And in some ways, what I saw there happening and the way people were articulating things, literally, John, while the buildings were still burning, people were talking like this. This wasn't like 6 months later, hindsight. This wasn't, I'm trying to justify my actions. This was yesterday I hit that building because of X, Y, and Z. Yesterday I didn't hit that building because of X, Y, and Z. And the anger, what's going on now, is valid, more than valid.
But it also legitimized everything that had been said in the music, every place the culture was going. Everything that the mainstream media disagreed with and didn't want to be true, it all happened. You couldn't question NWA, Ice-T, anything like that ever again. You couldn't question the gang situation. You couldn't say you didn't understand it, because they were warning the world. For as long as there was rap music and as long as Black people and Mexicans were in Los Angeles, and this happened. It doesn't happen just because people or feeling economically constrained or immobilized by their conditions. This always happens as a result of police brutality. That's the only thing that really sets our community off in this manner. And when you think of all the things that we suffer, right, we make the best out of a bad situation, which is, something I believe you should just never do. I shouldn't be in a bad situation.
Right. The situation is the problem, not the response to it.
So, yes, on one hand, you can say, well, it's not constructive to burn down your own community, but I think we burned down less of our communities this time. And lo and behold, a Black woman is elected mayor of Ferguson, Missouri, something that 6 years ago seemed very remote. So things that happen now, we'll see what the story is 6 years from now, 10 years from now, where we are. Because right now, you can't say that it's not your problem. And it's not really Black people's problem to solve. Everyone has a hand in the solution, but there's no hiding. When they pull the gate off the Breitling watch store on Fifth Avenue, it's real. When they're inside Macy's on 34th Street, it's real. When they're on Fifth Avenue, it's real. So you can ignore this, but you've already seen what can happen. And this was like the B team, the C team that was out in the streets just wild. And these were the kids. This wasn't targeted grown folks who know how to organize and are out to really make a possibly negative statement. This is the warning. Nobody's afraid of police. No one's afraid of the military. No one's afraid of helicopters, because this is what you've made. And how many MFs and everything else were cops called all this week and all last week? Right to their faces, right? So you can ignore this, or you can actually enact some real reforms. People will do their part to vote, get the right people in office. But, I don't know about decertifying all police, but those unions need to be looked at. The relationships between prosecutors and police need to be looked at, because they wait 8 days, 9 days to arrest everyone, where if the four officers were arrested by last Thursday, maybe half of this stuff wouldn't have happened.
One of the things when I see people talking about legal reforms that are actually potentially on the table right now, one, you know, in keeping with what you were just talking about, a lot of cities or municipalities have laws that keep police disciplinary records confidential and private. And there are movements in various places to repeal those laws or to repeal those protections. And I think that ties in with the union thing that you're talking about in the relationship between union and prosecutors. It's all of a piece.
But how do you even address the problem when outside of the independent media, you can't go anywhere and get an official count of how many people police shoot in a year? So you don't know what the situation is. Like, we know what it is. But I think once those numbers come out, it'll be understood that systemic change needs to happen.
Those folks in LA in 92 were like, this is the last straw, and there's stuff beyond law enforcement that we want changed. You know, this coronavirus sort of laid bare a lot of different things. And you can imagine, or I could only dream, that larger demands could come out of this thing.
You talk about independent media providing accurate coverage of how police actually function in American cities. Did you feel that the source during your era was also a form of an accountability tool?
We were trying to hold the mainstream media accountable. We were also trying to hold ourselves accountable. Chuck D of Public Enemy said the reason he started the group was that he wanted to create 5,000 black leaders. And no one had asked me to participate in anything in my life. And this man said I could be a leader. So I became one. And who knows, you know, I think I've done a lot of good in the world, but I could have also easily done a lot of bad. So, you know, the life you save might be your own sometimes.
I can't say anything after that. You can't ask another question.
Let me just say, the day after the Rodney King videotape surfaced, which, sure, today you can capture all of this anytime you want. Anytime something happens, you can pull out a recording device. Someone heard a commotion from across the street, grabbed a video camera, went to their window, and recorded this beating. So if you wonder how many people are not recorded now, no one was recorded back then because we weren't under constant surveillance. That footage goes to the news. Everyone around the world watches this, and we're appalled. I've never seen someone hit the head with a nightstick 20 times and still trying to get up, and they're saying you're trying to resist. But I'm like, man, I think that was like muscle memory. His nervous system was in operation. Like, he was not thinking.
Trying to get away. Trying to get your attack. You're under attack.
So next morning, I come to work. I'm in the office like 8 o'clock. It's only me and the publisher, and I'm trying to get some work done. Phone rings. So before the receptionist arrives, whoever's around picks up the phone. I pick up the phone, and there's a guy, sort of has a Midwestern accent, and this is like 8 in the morning, and he's just almost hyperventilating. He's so exercised, and he's like, did you see what the police did to that man? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I saw it on the news. He's like, I can't believe they did this. What is the source going to do? Are you going to cover it? You have to cover it. Please cover it. We need to know. You guys have to do it. They're not telling us the truth. And that was the relationship that we had with the readership, that we had with the community. Some man called up the number in the magazine to talk to someone at 8 in the morning to vent about what he had seen, because he knew it was important. He knew we were going to be in position to cover it the way it needed to be covered.
I think we take for granted, looking back in the rearview mirror, how important the source was as a voice in terms of articulating the politics of this generation. But it's important to also keep in mind that you guys were also, not making it up as you went along, but you're sort of inventing it month to month and adding, you know, Reggie, you had a very good point very early in the conversation, which is hip hop was all of these things. It was politics, it was style, it was music. And that afforded you the space to go in any one of these directions and make it part of what the magazine responsibility was. And the thing that I often think about when I think about entertainment publications, music publications, is there is a moral imperative to cover the potentially challenging topics that the artwork discusses and necessitates. And it's interesting that we're talking about The Source in 1992, because that's The Source in 1992 sort of had a wide berth and not loads of competition. This is just before Vibe starts. Obviously, there's Rap Pages and Rap Sheet and things like that, but you guys had a very, very wide berth, and you really got to set the table and the boundaries of, or really just to say there are no boundaries to what a hip-hop magazine and an informed hip-hop listener and enthusiast should care about. And I think that changed what a generation thought of and how they viewed themselves.
I think you're right. And we thought about ourselves as artists. You know, we thought we were putting out albums. We used to say this back in the day, that like every month was a statement, you know? So it wasn't even really journalism. You know, I mean, I wasn't going out there to be unbiased. You know what I'm saying? You know, I didn't loot, but we were making statements. And every month we started from scratch. And it was kind of like, what are we going to say this month? We did a three-part series celebrating the 10th anniversary of crack. That's also newsworthy one day.
Before we go, you know, Reggie, you alluded to something earlier that I think may not be totally, especially for younger listeners, they may not totally understand. But you were talking about the newsstand and how important it was to be set. You know, we're selling the issue. At that time, what were The Source's newsstand sales like? Like, what was it, mostly a newsstand thing, or was it mostly subscriptions?
In New York City, we outsold Time Magazine, Newsweek, Rolling Stone. I started out in retail sales for the magazine. And I would go to meetings with distributors who would not take The Source on because, what is this? How do we rack this? People would call the distributors. They would call outlets. Where's this magazine I've heard of? Where's this magazine I've heard of? Places like Tower Records in San Francisco, 900 copies a month, right? The circulation director of Rolling Stone calls me. They want to bundle The Source with Rolling Stone. But they want to know, can we get Rolling Stone into the locations that The Source is? Because we've never heard of any of these places.
Oh my God.
Where people are buying the magazine. Because we're in the hood. And we're teaching people how to retail a magazine, how to do returns, how to organize this thing, how to promote it. And it was a 50-state strategy that we did. So in 1992, maybe the majority of sales were in New York and New Jersey. So if you're in Houston and a magazine had just sold out, or two guys grabbed it at the same time, there would be a fight. So there was the scarcity. But people wanted the potency of the information, because we were on their side. We were on the side of the reader. So newsstands were kind of a very sort of staid, almost genteel kind of thing, because it works one way and no one sees fit to reinvent anything, because you don't really get paid to reinvent anything, because magazines will be here forever. Why should we change anything? And basically, everything we wanted to do, there was some pushback from a magazine consultant or whomever. There's too many scowling black people on the cover. Can someone smile once in a while? Oh, we can't have a black man with a gun in his hand. Okay, how about if Dr. Dre puts the gun to his own head? Oh, well, maybe that'll work. Okay, so these were things that we were always cognizant of. Can you make a magazine pop off the rack when you walk by and see it? Is that logo going to work? But it was really the material. It was really the content. People looked for The Source. If people didn't have it, people requested that they order it. And that's really what happened. So we weren't forcing anything down anyone's throat. We were trying to meet the demand. But the demand was always out there. It was just the industry, who had never dealt with anything like this before, had to figure out a way to be in business with us. And basically all they had to do was make it available on a nationwide scale, and it sold itself. Or as somebody wrote in, it sold like crack.
And of course, the crucialness of the newsstand model, which is not the contemporary model at all, obviously, which is online first. But, you know, I think of the rollout of Murder Dog. I think of the rollout of Feds. Don Diva. That is the same template.
We were doing true crime. We were doing, you know, rappers in their cars. We were doing the materialistic stuff as well. But you do stuff like that, and then Chuck D would pull you aside and be like, hey, man, what about the culture? What about the politics? Like, what is all this fluff? I don't read the source, for sneakers, right? But we knew all of that would have its time.
And also, it should be said, Public Enemy had a very robust merchandise enterprise. It should be said. So just for the record.
The best logo ever.
Great logo. Great logo.
We were always trying to find that balance. But like I said, if we only covered politics, I would have been happy with that. If we only covered music, I would have been happy. If we only covered fashion, I would have been happy. If we only covered sports, I would have been happy. Because all of these things were converging. And we were the only people who could be there.
Reggie, James, I appreciate you for what you've done and for what you helped build for my generation and the generations beyond. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before we go, another week, another after the fact insertion to Popcast, because things are changing rapidly. Something that happened actually the day that we recorded this, I noticed just before we started recording, one of my colleagues and old friends, Jenna Wortham, had posted on Twitter a protest against an op-ed that the New York Times had published. It was by a Republican senator about military intervention. I don't want to get into all the details. The point was, she voiced this protest. And I saw that right before we started recording, and I was very struck for a number of reasons. People may or may not know this, but working at the New York Times, there are certain boundaries that we are not allowed to cross, or we're not expected to cross. We don't make donations to political candidates or causes. We are not allowed to speak about our political opinions. And we're often strongly, strongly, strongly discouraged from speaking about basically in-house business. And so I was even more moved when I noticed after we were recording this episode, I went on Twitter and I saw that dozens of people had tweeted and retweeted the sentiment. People who work for the New York Times, people who don't work for the New York Times, and saying that publishing that piece put Black New York Times staffers in danger, Black lives in danger. And statements of human rights like that feel like they should be made. I think if you've been paying attention to what's been happening in the 2 or 3 days since that protest, you'll see that people are having hard conversations inside and outside the paper. And it's been really encouraging. And I'm incredibly proud to work alongside my colleagues taking a stand like that. I'm grateful for them. I support them. I stand with them. And I hope everybody listening will stand with us too. That's our show. Thanks again to Reggie and James. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Check out the Facebook group. Get involved. Get chatty. I'm thinking of maybe doing like a AMA type thing on the Facebook group while we are all still in varying stages of sheltering in place. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to Podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, etc., etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. 89 the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer. Music hitting your heart, 'cause I know you got soul.